Okay, Walter, can you hear me?
I can.
Outstanding. Okay, I just kind of did a setup, and I don't know if you saw my email earlier, but I wanted to set up this oil question because oil's been hot in the news, and I thought, okay, what's the best way to set up a good question about root causes without getting into the technicals of it. Basically, I surveyed the news, and you see root causes anywhere. You know, obviously the left is very hard over on saying that it's going to be that it's the oil companies, especially the American oil companies, because they're the near target and the target for their confiscations and taxes and on windfall profits, and that's the Obama goal. But I also see, even from the right, a lot of inconsistency of what they think root causes are. And I never see people get down to, I mean, I see things about the futures market and things about, is it a natural supply demand curve or not? I suspect it's kind of a mixed bag, and I'll let you talk in a second. What I'm smelling out, though, is that really the oil cartels of OPEC, and that's the big one, and apparently that's about 40% of the overall oil production is put out by OPEC countries. But I also read in another article, another 40% is also put out by nationalized governments, either in collusion or on their own, and therefore less than 20% is produced by private companies worldwide. So I don't know, maybe I don't know how deep you've done research on this, but it seems like it would be rather easy to collude as a government and to set prices rather than being a private firm where you're accountable to shareholders. What's your sense of the anti-competitive behavior in the setting of the price of oil?
Well, I agree with you, and I think you're making some very good points. I would just add a few more. First of all, the price of oil is as high as it is, partially because hello?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Because there's some sort of echo.
Oh, sorry about that. Let me move some phones around. That might help. Go. I'm not hearing an echo, but I don't know if hopefully...
Okay, I guess I'll just have to deal with it. One of the reasons that the oil price is so high is because the dollar is so weak. One of the reasons that the dollar is so weak is because the U.S. government has been inflating the currency. But even in real terms, the oil prices are much higher now than they were 10, 20, 30 years ago. But part of it is because of inflation. Another part, as you aptly put, is due to governments. OPEC is 40%. You have other governmental agencies involved for another 40%. You know, it's a governmental problem. A lot of the critics say, well, this is free enterprise failing us again, but it seems that rather it's government failing us. Now, government fails us, so far we've mentioned two ways. One, they're the inflators. Two, they're the owners. A third way that they screw around with the prices or make the price of oil higher than it otherwise would be is because they interfere with supply. They don't allow drilling in Alaska. They don't allow drilling offshore. They don't allow drilling here. They don't allow drilling there. But not just drilling oil, because there are substitutes for oil, for example, nuclear power. Now, I don't have the data in front of me, but my recollection is that we haven't had in the U.S. any new nuclear installations in, what, 10, 20, 30 years?
Maybe
40 years, I'm not sure, but it's decades, it's not years.
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing too, yeah.
Now, if we were allowed to have more nuclear power developed, we would have a substitute for oil, and the oil prices would not be allowed to go as high as they are. So when you get down to it, government has got its mitts all over the problem, and yet somehow the talking heads, the pundits, the people in Washington, D.C. are talking about speculators. Now, the function of speculators has got nothing to do with high prices. Rather, speculators tend to even out prices. You know, there's the joke about the old speculator was on his deathbed and he was teaching the young sprout speculator how to speculate. and his advice was buy low and sell high. Well, if they buy low and sell high, when they buy low, they raise the prices, and when the prices are high and they sell, they lower the prices. So what speculators do is not raise nor lower prices, but even them out. They dampen down the oscillations of prices so that the prices don't move around like on a roller coaster. Rather, they move lower gradation.
Oh, I love that analogy because I'm a controls guy, you know, in my day job, and I play around with dampening, and you can see that effect, you know, in the physical world, and that's perfect. I see a good one third of those articles are saying that speculators are driving it up, and I just don't see that. Now, is it true though that if somebody was to invest in Exxon or Royal Dutch Petroleum or any of those companies as just a normal stock investment, would investing in the company in mass tend to drive oil prices up?
Well, I would say no, it would be the very opposite. The more investment you have, the greater the supply is, the lower the prices would be. You see, if we erased government, and suppose we said that, I don't know what, rubber bands or chewing gum or something like that, some innocuous good, all good bars, the price was rising. Well, high prices or rising prices are a signal. It's sort of like when hikers get lost in the woods, what they try to do is they yell, help, help, and the louder they yell, the more likely they are to get help. Well, high prices are like a call for help. It's the market's way of saying, hey, we need some more chocolate or toothbrushes, if those are the things that have the prices go up. And there are two salutary effects of a higher price. One, on the demand side, people tend to ration the stuff. When the price of oil or gasoline goes up to $10 a gallon, if it does, people are going to start thinking twice before getting in the old car, and they're going to get into a very small car instead of a big SUV. So you have a tendency that people will tend to ration it. Now, on the other hand, when prices rise, that is, if you don't have government all over the lot like you do in oil, but take chocolate or toothbrushes or paper clips, if the price rises, other things equal, that means the profits are higher. And if the profits are higher, this serves as like a red flag for the bull. Namely, more investments go in there, and that pushes down the price.
Yeah.
So the price system is a very wondrous spectacle. We have this thing called the magic of the market. Well, part of the magic of the market is high prices. And high prices call forth new supplies, thus lowering prices. And they also call upon people to not use as much of the good at a higher price than they would use at a lower price.
Oh, that's just perfect. And while you're talking about profit, the frequent attack on the oil companies is that they've made record profits. Just from my standpoint, if you're growing positively as a country, you better hope some of your companies are making record profits. They would have to be if you're going to have positive economic growth.
High profits aren't really necessarily a signal of growth. Benefit. It's rather a signal that you need help here. It's sort of like if I were to stick a pin in someone, all the white blood corpuscles would come to that spot to fight off the pin or the poison or whatever. It's like profits are the white blood corpuscles of the body, and they're fighting off the high scarcity. Let me give you another example. I'm from New Orleans. I'm a professor at Loyola University in New Orleans.
Yeah.
And we had this storm called Katrina. I don't know if anyone's heard about it, but it was pretty famous a few years ago. And in New Orleans history, I think it'll never be forgotten. Well, what happened during Katrina is that the prices of things that people wanted catapulted. They went up into the atmosphere. For example, flashlight batteries and candles and gasoline and milk and orange juice and diapers and things like that.
Yeah.
People were in dire straits. They needed them. So the prices catapulted. Well, when the prices catapulted, if you're in the supermarket, instead of buying 20 gallons of milk, most of which is going to go bad, at the old prices you might have been tempted to do it, but when prices are 10 times higher, you tend to be more judicious and more civilized and allow other people to have some. And also, except the FEMA, which stopped the whole process, but that's government for you, if you had had high prices for these things, then there would have been profits for people to bring stuff in from Tennessee and Texas and Idaho and wherever else. In other words, the high prices were a cry for help on the part of New Orleanians. And yeah. What the governor of New Orleans or the governor of Louisiana rather said is she's going to put price gougers in jail. Well, that's interfering with the market signal, which is trying to help the people in effect.
Yeah, no, that's true. Now, if even on the very local level, if you're on the street corner and you know the water's been poisoned or you can't drink it, and a guy's got a bottled water and he's selling it for let's say $10 a bottle. That's kind of the classic gouge. They say, well, no, look, here's people in need. They need relief. They're suffering already, and here's a guy selling water for $10 a bottle. But isn't that where the relief efforts come in? Now there's that. Yeah, I'm thinking, the markets work for almost everything. Relief efforts are by and large believed to be, whether it's fire or police, or bringing provisions in to people who are somehow isolated and need immediate relief. That seems to be a government function. So I could see where they might be a little hostile toward a guy selling water for $10 for a small bottle.
Well, I don't really see helping people as a government function. I mean, we have this joke, I'm from the government, I'm here to help you. That's nonsense. What happened in New Orleans is that FEMA not only didn't help people, but it prevented places like Walmart from bringing food in and bringing ice and bringing water and stuff like that. No, I don't think government is the good guy. I think government is the bad guy, at least with regard to Katrina. The whole thing was caused initially by the Army Corps of Engineers screwing around with the levee. And in the case of oil, with which we started, again, you see government's fingerprints all over the problem. The government is not the solution. The government is the problem, in my view.
Yeah, I agree. On balance, the government creates far more problems and compounding problems. Maybe, not one large problem by one act, but certainly in a compounded fashion, they can raise risks as what happened in New Orleans, to the point where you were very vulnerable to not even a full force hurricane, right? It was a category 3 or something when it hit the coast. And
hurricane missed us. It just sort of hit us peripherally. It mainly Mississippi.
Yeah, it seems like you're right, but a point well taken. The government created the vulnerability more than it had the private sector been able to. If the government could contract certain things out, I mean, I understand the competitive model for contracting, that certainly would have been an improvement. But
well, I'm not sure about that because, where did the government get a comparative advantage in contracting out stuff? I mean, government is really naked force. What the government is a bayonet or a club or a gun, and they say, you're going to be part of our club, government club, whether you like to or not. So I don't really see, I'm not really much of a fan of government.
Yeah.
I imagine if they take half the GDP, they got to do some good. But the point is that with the money that they took, we could have done much better good for ourselves. Look, it's not that the government screws up, although it always does. It's rather that when it screws up, it stays in business. Katrina is another case in point. FEMA is still in business. One of my favorite bumper stickers, by the way, is FEMA happens. Well, they're still in business. The Army Corps of Engineers is still in business. Imagine if a private company screwed up in such a royal way and killed, I think 1,100 people died, or was it 1,500, something like that, they'd be out of business in a minute. So the point is that in the market, when you have failure, and, to fail is to be human, or to be human is to fail, we all make mistakes. That's why they put erasers on the back of pencils. But in the market, if you fail, you go broke, and then you make way for somebody else who can do a little bit better of a job. But these are the people who brought us the post office. How good a job of the Motor Vehicle Bureau. Why would we expect them to rescue anyone?
Yeah, the efficiency and productivity is obviously woefully, short of what can be done by the private sector. And now, as you're saying this, I'm looking through one of these articles, which kind of lays out a litany of government contributions to this oil price thing, including the higher operating costs due to regulations of the oil industry, the proliferations of grades of gasoline that they're forced to create, the recovery of from low and negative rates of return on investment in the 90s, which I don't know how that somehow we've carried this historical burden, and maybe that's something that the companies themselves are doing, but they're implying in here that the government is actually trying to do some recovery of their own. In other words, there's like if you put on a gas tax, it goes into a general fund usually. I mean, they'll talk about it going to this or that, but eventually it just goes into a general fund, or they try to it's just a revenue enhancer.
Well, I think you're putting your finger on a very important point, and that's something that we've forgotten previously, that when you go to the pump and you pump in gas at, what is it, $4, $4.50 now?
Yeah.
An awful lot of that is tax. The government is taxing a lot of it, and if they're so concerned about high prices, they could forego their tax. And also, the government interferes with productivity in so many, many other ways. Affirmative action lowers productivity, regulations, red tape. You have to hire an army of tax lawyers to fill out your taxes, and I don't mean just personally, but as far as the corporation is concerned. Those people, instead of filling out government forms in triplicate, could have been producing stuff, and again, prices would be lower. So government has got its hands on every part of the pie or the oil barrel, and for the say that it's, you know, the market's fault, or it's speculators, or greed, or capitalism, or profits, they're out for lunch.
Yeah, and we forget the 35% income tax that the corporations pay, which is one of the highest in the civilized world, as I understand it.
Well, the taxes are too high also, that's for sure.
So what it ends up to be a compounded tax with every regulation, with every tax to the, that gets passed to the consumer. Of course, it all gets passed to the consumer, but...
Right.
But it's very much compounded. If you looked at the true cost, now someone in one of these left-wing blogs was saying the true cost of producing a barrel of oil is only $30, and the price of the barrel of oil is $140. Of course, they didn't show where they got those numbers, but I suspect they didn't add on all the downstream and refinement, distribution, production costs. That they're saying that that's the price of the barrel of oil, but they must be cutting out a lot of okay, let's take distribution out. Let's just get to the point where you have a barrel of oil. Like from what you said, the taxes on the corporation itself, the regulation, the labor. Affirmative action, all those, and so many unquantifiable regulations and restrictions.
Yeah, you're quite right. Another cost that the lefties probably wouldn't count is advertising. They have a vitriolic hatred for advertising. They don't realize that the final product is not the final product until it's in the consumer's hands. No good producing shoes or Twinkies or oil or anything if nobody buys it. You got to sell it, and there is such a thing as selling costs.
Sure.
But the ultimate cost is the alternatives foregone, and the alternatives, not so much the historical cost, but the alternatives foregone. And whatever the costs are, I mean, if someone is willing to pay that price for it, that's what the cost of a barrel of oil is or a gallon of gasoline.
Yeah, and something I forgot to mention, I was actually talking about it before you came on, there's a cost that's imposed by the hostilities when there's insecurity in when you're going to bring a team out to Iraq, if supposedly some of the companies are going to be out working in hostile territories, there's obviously, you know, increased pay and security that needs to be paid for. But there also the transaction cost. If I can ask a general question, if security is lowered, does not that deter transactions in general? It would kind of make a smaller mid-sized company shy away because of the increased risks. And so even if on paper they show that they could make a profit from a transaction, if there's some intangibles and unknowns and fears that they're going to have based on lack of security, they're not going to make the deal.
Well, I think you put your finger on a very, very important point. I don't see why you need me. You're doing a great job without me, but I'm glad that you're including me in this. That was two magnificent points. One, the Iraq business. I mean, we're bombing people who have oil, and we expect the price of oil to be lowest in the past. Obviously, if other people who have oil now see themselves as a U.S. target, then that'll put a kibosh on some supply, and the less supply, the higher the price. So I think that the war in Iraq is a debacle, not only morally and in terms of our security, but it also is a devastation in terms of the oil price. And this leads me to another lack of security, especially in foreign countries, you know, and not just with oil, but with any mineral, you know, gold, silver, cadmium, copper, whatever. You go into a country in South America or Africa or wherever, where their adherence to property rights is only theoretical, not practical. That is, that they don't respect private property rights.
Yeah.
And they allow some U.S. or Western European company to come in there, and as soon as they find oil or gold or uranium or whatever it is that they're looking for, all of a sudden they try to nationalize it and take back a lot of the property that they had accorded to the private corporation. Well, that too is a lack of security, and when government does that, that's another way of elevating the prices of everything.
Yeah, certainly the investor's going to want some very high insurance to try to offset that risk, and that's going to deter a lot of investors.
I think you're absolutely right.
Well, let's another thing I want to try to run by you, which is. Now that we've talked a lot about oil, and we know that energy in general, just to back out to energy and the infrastructure that runs on energy primarily. In other words, a great large cost of some of our infrastructure and a lot of our companies is an energy cost, and it seems to be. I don't know. I know there's been some studies out there that try to show this kind of a exponential effect, but certainly that's something that much at the core of the infrastructure is going to inflate costs across all industries. And I don't know how much you've gotten into that kind of I guess they call it what economists call it a negative externality, right? Just bad.
Not exactly a negative externality, that's rather an input, and the point is that oil or energy is an input into many, many industries, and if the price of oil rises, then the price of everything that uses oil or other sources of energy also rises. Externalities are a little bit different. Negative externalities, for example, would be a case where I build a tire. I'm a tire company, and I build tires. And out of my smokestack comes soot, and it stays or gets on your property and in your lungs, and this is what's called the negative externality. A positive externality is supposedly education. If I become more educated, then I'm a better citizen, and I'm less likely to be a criminal, and this benefits you even though you don't pay for it. So these are the classic market failures, so-called, beloved of leftist economists and other lefties, but I don't believe that these are market failures. I never met a market failure. I only see government failures all over the place.
the market is going to...
Answer to these two objections, having raised them, the supposed negative externality of pollution is not really an externality. It's rather a government sets itself up as the judge and the judiciary, and it's supposed to uphold private property rights. And what pollution really is, the trespass of soot particles onto other people's property. So it's not an externality, or rather the reason it's an externality is the government refuses to uphold the law of property rights. Now, with regard to positive externalities, education, they use as an example, soap might be another case. You know, if I take a shower, I benefit you because I don't smell bad or whatever. What they're saying is that the government should now subsidize education and soap, and this is silly. In terms of education, it's very subjective as to whether education is a positive benefit or not a positive benefit. You know, one man's meat is another man's poison. I am a professor in a university, and I tell you, most of what university education consists of is multiculturalism and feminism and black studies and sociology and other irrational fields.
They're political movements is what they are.
Students who come out of there are more socialistic than they came in. It's no accident that rent control is most popular in the People's Republic of Santa Monica or Ann Arbor or Cambridge, Mass., because you have many universities around there. So at least as good a case could be made that education is a negative externality as a positive externality. What we ought to do is tax it instead of subsidize it. Maybe the whole thing is silly. What the government should do, if it's going to do anything, is just uphold property rights, and it's too busy not upholding property rights and doing everything else under the sun. By the way, I thought of yet another cost, cause of why oil is costly, and that is unions.
Oh, yeah.
Unions are involved in the, I'm losing my marbles here. The energy business, they're unions, and unions traditionally raise prices too, and unions are really a creature of the government. So again and again, we keep coming up with more and more examples of where government is raising prices and screwing up the works.
Yeah, yeah, and it's it has, and I keep looking for just like when I learned about compound interest and how fascinating that was, and how you could put, you know, small amount of money, and if you just kept putting in every year the same amount, that you could have millions of dollars after 30 years. And it's the same kind of effect that I'm seeing, these compounding factors that are that now as our economy seems to be much more interrelated with many technologies and many processes that overlap and outsource in a very complex way, that now if you start taxing or regulating the energy industry, now you get a much more pronounced exponential impact, negative impact on growth. And just the numbers I looked at the last 5 years, our productivity per person, our, you know, per capita productivity has gone up, I think, 3% each of the last 5 years, but our economic growth is I think struggled to make 2% in the United States. And
we're spending money like drunken sailors in Iraq and Afghanistan on all sorts of welfare. I mean, the government is taking almost half of the GDP and wasting it pretty much, and it's hard to see great growth in that way. The fastest growing countries in the last 10 years, I think, are India and China. And
yes.
They're more free enterprise than we are in many ways. So this is almost a disgrace. George Bush is acting like a socialist, and the commies in China and the socialists in India are, you know, doing way better than we are.
Yeah, it's troubling if your productivity, now maybe it's not a one-to-one, you probably looked into this to some extent, but you know, productivity seems to be, you know, a core factor in growth, and if our productivity is increasing at a faster rate than our growth is, something's wrong. It probably means that regulation is taking more money out of the economy at a faster rate than productivity can make up for it.
I think you're putting your finger on a very important point yet again. Boy, if you were in my class, I'd give you an A in economics. You're doing very well. One of the key elements of productivity is capital, the amount of capital that labor has to work with. If you're digging a foundation for building with your fingernails, you're not going to do too well. A teaspoon will be better, and a shovel and pick and shovel will even be better, but a steam shovel would be even better than that. But in order to get a steam shovel, you have to have a lot of capital, and the way you get capital is through savings. But the way you get savings is through free enterprise. The more economic freedom we have, the more likely it is that people are to save and invest in our economy. And fortunately, we're going in the wrong direction in so many ways under George Bush, and I fear that under Obama or McCain, we're not going to be getting back on the right track either.
It's terrible. Isn't it kind of like, if you're the father of a family and you're not really watching what's going on with what your kids and are spending money on, and maybe dad's off making 10% raises every year, but maybe the wife and kids are spending at an increasingly higher rate and going out and getting more credit cards and unbeknownst to the breadwinner. Now what happens if that growth rate in that guy's career, has to plane off eventually?
I think you're quite right that the father is like the populace, and the mother who's running up credit card bills is like George Bush. George Bush has got a credit card of the U.S. Productivity, and he's wasting it on all sorts of frivolities and very dangerous things. We have, 730 foreign military bases in 130 different countries. Now, that costs trillions of dollars, and we have a vast debt and it's paying off the debt. George Bush is like this woman who's a shopaholic, I think they call it. a drunken sailor is the other analogy to that. And as long as we have that sort of a government, increases in productivity aren't going to help. As you say, if the dad is getting raises but the family is spending it at an increasing rate, that's not a recipe for a good economy.
Yeah, I agree. It's it seems like a train wreck waiting to happen. We're become so used to the rapid advance of technology that it seems to be increasing exponentially in a steady exponential rate. They talk about the Moore's law, which is the doubling of computer power every 18 months, and that's certainly been true for the last 20 years, but there's nothing that's going to guarantee that those rates will continue.
And even if they continue, if the politicians and the government wrap it up at an even faster rate, as you say, that's a train wreck waiting to happen. Indeed, that's a train wreck that's sort of happening even now as we speak. What with the real estate bubble and the high prices of gasoline and oil and all, we're not in very good times right now, so I wouldn't say it's a train wreck right now, but it's the prognostication doesn't look too good.
Oh, yeah, well, that's great. Well, while we have just a few minutes left, I do want to ask you, since you reminded me about the real estate bubble, here's where you're going to have to give me less than an A. I don't know exactly what the principle behind what the Fed is doing when the Fed drops the interest rate to when Greenspan drops it to the prime rate to 2% or whatever he lowered it to. It would seem to have been below what the market rate would have produced, would have emerged in the market from if the banks had been unregulated by the Fed. So does that have the effect of driving inflation up directly, or is that a more complex kind of relationship?
No. I think that there are two schools of thought on this, two supposed free enterprise schools of thought, the Austin School, which I'm an adherent, and the Chicago School, and both agree that when the government pumps excessive money into the system by lowering interest rates, you do get inflation. But then the Chicagoites drop out and the Austrians continue, and they say not only is there inflation, but there's also a business cycle that's created, because the artificially lower rates of interest subsidize and encourage investments in the heavy orders, the higher orders of production, heavy industry, that is not sustainable based on the time preferences or the savings rates of the people. And what you have every once in a while is a nasty recession or depression, which in the Austrian view is a way of cleansing the economy. And if the government would allow it to occur, it would be short and sweet, well, short and bitter anyway. Whereas what happens with the Keynesians, what they did in the 1930s is they just exacerbated and lengthened and strengthened the depression. They had the Smoot-Hawley tariff, and we're getting a little bit of that now with the protectionism of Obama.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I think that the Fed ought to be abolished, and we ought to go back to gold money. We shouldn't have U.S. fiat currency. It's very easy for the government to inflate. You see, there are only three ways that the government has to get money. One is taxes. The problem with taxes, everyone knows who's doing it. The other is borrowing, and again, everyone knows who's doing that. The third way is inflating. And here, people are not so sophisticated. They think that inflation comes about from greed or people spending too much money. No, it occurs part of the centralized bank and the Fed. So we'd be much better off getting rid of the Fed and going back to gold. Now, let me just spend a minute on the housing bubble.
Yeah.
What happened, traditionally, if you want to borrow money to buy a house, get a mortgage, you have to have, collateral. You have to show a good work record. You have to show that you paid off debts in the past. You have to show that you have a job, that you're not a drunkard, whatever.
Yeah.
Namely, you have to convince the banker that you're likely to repay the mortgage.
Yeah.
Well, this is the way it was going for a long time. But then our friends on the left discovered that bank loans were not going equally to all races and all groups and all genders and all whatever other way that you want to break up society, but rather some peoples or some groups had more collateral and therefore they got more loans than other groups. So they said, well, this is unfair, this is racism or sexism or some sort of ism, and we got to stop that. And now what the banks are told to do under very severe penalties is to give loans to people without collateral, to give loans to people who haven't got a record of repaying past loans, who don't have a steady job, who don't have likelihood to repay. So they gave loans to people, sometimes 100% of the house, and then when we had an overbuilding of houses based on the Fed and the interest rate that I just spoke about, these people couldn't pay the mortgage. So you had a big crunch and a big bubble here. But again, this is brought to you by your friendly local neighborhood and federal government.
Unbelievable. See, I did not know that connection. I knew that there was some programs for where they had to give high-risk loans. I don't know if the government I had assumed the government somewhat would guarantee those loans, but I guess not. Because,
well, these loans were packaged and served as the basis of borrowing and bonds and all. And when the people didn't repay their mortgages, the whole thing sort of burst.
Yeah.
But again, it was the crazy government. There was no racism or sexism or I don't know, ethnicism or whatever the word is. It was rather profit-making bankers want to loan money to people that they think will repay it. And if each group isn't equally represented in those who succeed in getting loans, well, you know, too bad.
Now, is there also a factor in there where there was some genuine speculation, over speculation, where, like, you know, I saw some people sitting next to me who would go out and get one of these variable rate interest loans, get a house that they normally couldn't afford on a fixed rate 6% loan, and then flip it over after 12 or 18 months and make a big profit. And so there was some of that speculation going on, and they were obviously able to pay, you know, when the interest rate was still low. So the bank was happy in the meantime, and a lot of people did make money and if they were able to flip the house like that. So was there a little bit of a Dutch tulip speculation going on there?
Well, I don't think that that was really the problem. When the housing prices are rising, anyone who's in the market starts to look good. But that goes with regard to any prices. But you're right. There is such a thing as over-speculation, or rather I'd call it bad speculation. The point, though, is that if you speculate erroneously and you don't buy low and sell high, well, then you lose your shirt. In other words, the speculators who remain in the market are pretty good. But when the government speculates, well, you know, then
races. You know, one last little academic point. How is it when if the Fed lowers the interest rate below market rates, how does it drive more overall money into the economy? Like let's say the total amount of currency in the economy somehow goes up. How does that happen?
The way they lower the interest rate is by buying up stuff. Usually bonds, but theoretically they could buy up anything. But what do they buy it with? They buy it with the checkbook money or the printing press, or in other words, what they're doing when they lower interest rates, and increasing the money stock are sides or two opposite sides of the same coin. Again, the way they're going to lower interest rates is by bidding up bond prices. Bond prices and interest rates go in opposite directions. So when they buy up a bond, they buy it with newly created money. Well, the newly created money lowers interest rates and creates inflation, or is inflation.
Okay, so they do have to go print money in order to make that...
Well, in the old days they printed, now they would sometimes do it with checkbook money, but it's the same principle.
Yeah, and in other words, the overall liquidity, if you could add it all up, is increasing whenever they drive those interest rates down. Wow. Okay, and that eventually ends up in inflation. What do you think? Where are we going with this inflation? Is there a vector on there that you're, and, you know, not that predicting the future is safe for anybody to do, but do you see a bad trend of continuation of this inflation?
Yes, I mean any paper hanger Bernanke is off to the races. He should be. Disqualified, they ought to take back his PhD and, I don't know, fire him and get rid of the Fed. I see no good prognostication here as long as he's at the head of it, and I'm not a big fan of Alan Greenspan either. Nor am I the head of any of the heads of the Fed. I think that they're all a bunch of bad guys.
Yeah, it's a little bit too much power in one. If someone were to hand you the chair tomorrow, just for a fun last question,
hand
you the Federal Reserve chair, and
right.
And how would you determine how to set the rate? Would you just look out at a market survey and just try to peg it to what the market is doing?
Well, if I were the head of the Fed, I would do the best I could to withstand it. But given that I couldn't withstand it, what I would do is not increase the money supply at all. Milton Friedman had this thing that we should increase the money supply by 3%. But my co-author and I, Bill Barnett, wrote a paper saying that whatever fiat currency exists, the optimum amount is either zero fiat currency or whatever exists. So what I would do as head of the Fed, assuming that I didn't quit right away or try to get rid of the Fed, is I would just go play golf. I'd twiddle my thumbs. I'd go to movies. I wouldn't do anything.
One of the best things government people could possibly do as for service would be to do nothing in many cases.
That's it. Let them help us a little bit less. They help us too much.
You're wonderful, Walter. Thank you, and thanks for jumping on. I know you got a lot of things going on, and I appreciate making time. I really would love to do this in the future. You know, the story may get worse before it gets better, and the election is very interesting, especially with the libertarians. Where you know, I met you at the Libertarian Convention, and
yes.
And Bob Barr's looking like more of a factor all the time, and perhaps maybe not as a contender for the actual win, but certainly I think he's influencing the debate, and I hope. That some libertarian principles make it through on the economic front. And
that would be great.
I'd love to interview you about that.
It's a pleasure doing this with you, and I hope we do it again.
Yeah, thanks again, Walter. And I'll be talking to you soon, I'll send you a follow-up after the show. I'll let you know where it'll be posted on the site, you know, the recording, and hopefully we'll link it over there to Von Mises.
That'd be great.
Thanks again. Talk to you soon. Bye now. All right. Outstanding. That was Walter Block. Failed to give him a good introduction. I'll give him a post-introduction. He's a professor of economics at the University of Loyola at New Orleans.